It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. If you experience anxiety, you are far from alone. In fact, our next guest says anxiety is a common human experience, even though we don't always recognize it for what it is. And while it may affect people differently, there is some good news. We can learn to re-channel anxiety and use it as a force for good in our lives. In her new book, our guest shares a lot of strategies to help us understand our anxiety, find out what triggers it, and to help retrain our brains to live better with it. Wendy Suzuki is a professor of neuroscience and psychology in the Center for Neuroscience at New York University. She's an authority on neuroplasticity and mental health. Her new book is called Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. Wendy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to ask you first about the scope of anxiety in the United States when we include people with, you know, clinically diagnosable anxiety and people who have maybe not that level, but where anxiety is affecting their lives. How common is this?
Very, very common. Even before the pandemic started, 90% of Americans raised their hands and said that they experience anxiety very, very commonly. And that has only gone up. So basically all of us have anxiety. But as you point out, there's a wide spectrum of anxiety, from clinical anxiety, which is a different beast that needs medical attention, just like a broken leg would. My book focuses on the lower levels of severity of anxiety, what I call everyday anxiety, but that covers a huge swath of the American population these days.
It's kind of a twist here. I think a lot of people will have to, and I had to, stop and think about this, the idea that anxiety isn't in and of itself a bad thing, that there are things we can do, and we'll talk about what those things are, to use anxiety for a force for good in our lives. Can you make the case that it's worth taking the time to recalculate our thoughts about anxiety?
Absolutely. The reason why everybody needs to recalculate their views on anxiety is because high levels of chronic anxiety lead to high levels of chronic stress hormone, cortisol, in your system. We know that it's very bad for your physiological system. It can affect your heart, your digestive system, even your long-term reproductive systems are affected. And also, my specialty, the brain. Long-term high levels of stress hormones, cortisol, can first damage the input structures to brain cells called neurons, and then eventually, with really high levels that continue for a long time, can actually kill brain cells in two key brain areas, the hippocampus, critical for memory, and the prefrontal cortex, critical for decision making. Those are areas that you want to preserve for as long as you can. So this is why everybody should learn how to harness their anxiety to do good things in their lives.
I want to dig into one key concept that's going to let us help do that. Brain plasticity or neuroplasticity. What do we mean by that?
Brain plasticity is the brain's amazing ability to respond to the external environment. It can respond in a positive way by learning new things, taking advantage of creativity to solve problems, and to respond in a positive way to things like physical activity, meditation, good sleep that you provide the brain. Brain plasticity can also go in the negative direction. And the best example there is high levels of chronic stress can damage the brain for the long term. So we have the capacity to change our brains and make it stronger and better. And one of the things that we can do is decrease stress turning down the volume on our anxiety. And that can lead to a more creative and productive life.
We're talking to Wendy Suzuki about her new book. It's called Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about anxiety, what it is, how we know what it is, what it does to our brains? Have you come up with strategies in your life that let you deal with long-term or short-term anxiety yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Wendy, your book is full of concrete suggestions for figuring out our anxiety, what it is, what it does to us, and then how to deal with it. Let's start with the first step, recognizing anxiety. I've dealt with anxiety for years, only in the last couple of years did I know what to call it. How do we start to see how it is affecting our lives?
Yeah, that's a great point. So my simple definition of anxiety is that feeling of fear or worry that often accompanies uncertain situations. So that is kind of a clear definition of our life today with the coronavirus pandemic. It introduces so much uncertainty, and that has really increased our level of anxiety. But do you have that fear or your worry, whether you acknowledge it or you do like I've learned that I do all the time, which is kind of mask it and just ignore it. Mm-hmm. That is anxiety, and you want to put it in check. Make sure you understand it and are kind of using it to your best advantage, because it is a human emotion. It was evolved to protect us, even though it's not protecting us right now because its volume is too high. And that's why we really want to start to pay attention to it in a new way.
I want to talk about that idea of anxiety as something that evolved as a positive tool. Did I just see a tiger in the bushes over there or a snake or whatever? Anxiety can be a pretty good thing that gives me the energy and impetus I need to do something about it, right?
Absolutely. Even more than a good, pretty good thing, it is essential for our survival. We evolved the emotion of anxiety to kind of put us on edge and get us into action if we needed action. If we relied on our own decision-making skills, you know, sometimes maybe you do want to run away from the lion, sometimes you don't feel like it, and bam, you know, you're gone. So that, you know, you can imagine if you were somebody living 2.5 million years ago, it is essential. But jump to our present day, and we have things that provoke our anxiety that don't come along every once in a while. It's several times an hour. With the weather report can produce anxiety. The news feed, the social media feed, all are inducing anxiety. And these are all the things that are turning the volume up on our anxiety. And you know, too much of anything, even a good thing, is bad. And that is why our current kind of societal level of high levels of anxiety has lost its protective element. And so the first step in my book is learning how to turn it down.
Let's talk about figuring out maybe the unhealthy responses to anxiety we have. You've got some quizzes in your book. And I love that you do this in a very non-judgmental way, by the way, of saying, what negative behaviors does my anxiety drive me to that feel good in the short run, maybe, but over time they're bad?
Yes.
How do we start to spot those?
Well, you know, just start to list them. Also, I try to be not non-judgmental. You try and be non-judgmental on yourself. So I'll just use some of my own examples of anxiety coping strategies. They always involved sugar. So brownies, ice cream, a nice cold beer at the end of the day. Every once in a while, those things are great. But if I turn to those things every single time I feel anxious, that could lead quickly to rapid weight gain and not feeling so good overall. So what are some of those things in your life? Just to start, awareness is so key in this book. Awareness of your own anxiety, awareness that anxiety at its core is good. That is a really important, but it takes some time to wrap your head around that. But all of these awarenesses will lead to towards what I call good anxiety.
We're talking to Wendy Suzuki, professor of neuroscience and psychology in the Center for Neuroscience at New York University. We're talking about her new book. It's called Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. We'll pick up the conversation, get more strategies on dealing with our anxiety coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about anxiety and how we can actually use it for good and grow from it. Our guest is Wendy Suzuki, a neuroscientist from New York University. We're talking about her new book. It's called Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. You could join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Was there a time in your life where you felt like anxiety was getting the better of you day to day? How did you come out of it? If you came out of it, do you have advice maybe to share with others or a question about how anxiety works? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Wendy, we just talked about, you know, spotting the things that our anxiety triggers us to do. Let's take the next step now. When we're in that rut, when we've carved out that neural pathway that says anxiety equals the sugary treat or the drink or the road rage or whatever it might be, how do we start crafting that new path in a better direction?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the first step that I would take is to focus on the anxiety itself rather than the response to the anxiety. So I spent a lot of time coming up with a wide range of really doable tools to decrease the volume on our anxiety. And the very first tool that I give to everybody everywhere is breath, deep breath work. And did you know that breathing deeply is literally activating a part of your nervous system that is designed to de-stress you? Everybody's heard of the fight or flight response that comes with anxiety, that feeling of nervousness that is getting you ready to either fight the lion or run away. Did you know that there is an equal and opposite part of the nervous system that was designed to bring you back to normal states after stress? And this is what you are activating when you breathe deeply. This system does slow down your breathing. So this is something you can do consciously. It has an immediate effect on your feeling of anxiety. You can do it with your kids. You can do it in the middle of a conversation that is causing you anxiety. So it's a very powerful tool.
Another common theme in your book, Wendy, is kind of our self-talk, I guess, how we think in our brains about the problem that's causing or problems that are causing us stress and anxiety. How do we reframe those from negative, bad, self-judgmental ways of talking to more positive ways that are going to help help decrease that anxiety?
Yeah. I think I talk about something that's called the negativity bias in my book. So the negativity bias is something all humans have. When given an array of good and bad things, particularly about yourself, what do? You focus on that one comment that one person said that, you know, said that your talk was terrible when everybody else said it was great. And you focus on that. And it comes out in other ways. In meetings, one has to be very careful about the negative comments that one makes about a candidate or something being evaluated, because that has a lot more weight than a positive thing that you might say. We are just biased towards that. It is partially a protective mechanism, but it's partially recognizing that in ourselves. I actually was just called out for doing that to myself the other day by friends. And I thought, oh my God, I'm doing it to myself. One of the things that I found really helpful is I've had the opportunity to work with coaches career coaches, and they are so great at stepping back and really seeing both the best aspects of you and also the parts that need work, but couching it in a positive light. Can you learn to be your best coach? And even if you haven't had a coach, everybody has a friend that has that positive outlook. And so you can use that friend as a model to turn in on yourself and ask yourself, am I being that negative bias self, or am I being the good coach self? And that is a wonderful thing to practice.
Talking to Wendy Suzuki about her new book, Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. You could join in with your questions, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Wendy, it's interesting to me that people aren't calling in, and I think that may mean something. Are we too reluctant in some cases? I understand people might not want to do it on a radio show, but are we too reluctant to talk about something that's going on in our minds, like anxiety? Is that part of our problem?
Absolutely. In fact, with all the people I've talked to since the publication of this book, I've noticed that there's a lot of shame around the emotion of anxiety. And part of the book, and part of the reason I wrote the book, was an invitation to start the conversation. Why? Because 90% of Americans identified as anxious even before the pandemic. So basically, every single person in the room right now is feeling this feeling of anxiety. There's nothing to be shameful about. Everybody has this emotion. It is part of the human emotional spectrum. And so, while I totally understand that it takes a little while to wrap your head around that, there still is a lot of shame around anxiety. And so, you know, I shared all of my anxieties. You'll read all about them in my book. They're very common ones. And I was an anxiety denier, I learned while writing this book. I like to kind of hide the anxiety from the outside world. But I got over that because now I've written about it and everybody can learn about all of my anxieties in this book.
I think sometimes people might think of anxiety as being irrational, maybe. But I can think of a lot of rational reasons for people to be anxious about stuff. Am I going to get the job? Am I going to find a life partner? Hey, there's this pandemic. I'm worried about that. How do we deal with very reasonable anxieties in our lives so that they don't overwhelm us from minute to minute?
Well, I think that's a great question. And I would say that one of the tools that I think is so powerful in this book is the tool of mindset. How are you thinking about this? So instead of worrying about a job, your promotion, that is critical. And beating yourself up and saying, what's the matter with me? I can't get over this. Think about that emotion, that worry and that fear that might come with worrying about your job as a little sign or a big sign saying, this is something important. Pay attention to me. And that starts to make sense. That is useful. That is protective. Now, again, you can't do much if you're, in depths of anxiety. So that is why I gave so many tools to turn that volume down. But it's never going to go away. And that is the signal that I hear is a signal telling me, this is something that is important, or this is something that has worried me or scared me since I was a young child. And so I talk about my social anxiety that I had. I've gotten over it because I'm a professor, so I can speak, no problem. But I still have anxiety in social situations. And that came from years of, of suffering from social anxiety as a shy, awkward kid.
Let's go to our callers now. George is with us in Ashland. George, hi.
Good afternoon. I was listening to your conversation as I'm mowing the lawn here in Ashland. And it struck me that if a person identifies or identity is tied up with the thoughts going around in their heads, they're going to suffer more anxiety than if they just realize that their brain is going to spit out a lot of stuff that is not them, that they don't have to identify with, may make a difference for them.
That's interesting, George. So we don't have to identify ourselves. We are not our anxiety, he's saying, I think, Wendy.
I love that. I think that's a great way to think about it. A wonderful mindset shift, that those thoughts of worry are not me. That is something that I do because I'm a human, and I'm a human that has the emotion of anxiety. Great mindset tool.
George, thanks for that call. Nicole joins us now in Eau Claire. Nicole, hi.
Hi. This is a question for you about middle school, upper elementary students and some techniques for getting them to flip their self-talk or their mindset when they're sort of maybe above the idea of I'm going to breathe because people have been just telling me to breathe since I've been five, looking in the mirror and giving yourself that sort of like pep talk without actually making them think you just want to see them smile and say nice things.
Interesting. Nicole, great question and a great time to develop good self-talk habits, I imagine, Wendy.
Absolutely. And I think, there are so many different ways to do it. There are looking in the mirror, as you say. There are mantras that you can do. One of my favorite forms of exercise that I actually teach is a form of exercise called Intensati, that every single movement that you do is associated with a positive spoken affirmation. So there's jumping jacks and you say, I believe I will succeed during the jumping jacks or front punches that are associated with the saying, I am strong now. So there's a lot of fun ways to get your kids to kind of enact these take in these positive comments about themselves. And I bring this up because I've done this with kids. I've done this with adults. I've taught it for 7 years for free at NYU. And there's nothing like, you know, shouting out these positive things with a whole bunch of other sweaty affirmation shouting people. You feel a little silly at first, but you feel really good. And I've had parents and their kids send me videos of them doing the same affirmations that I put on Vimeo. And they say that they do it every morning together. So that might be an idea for you.
Thanks for the call, Nicole. I want to take our last half a minute or so, Wendy. One of my favorite bits of advice from your book is being creative as a tool to decrease anxiety. Leave us with a plug for that, please.
Yeah. So creativity is really part of the tools that you'll use to shift your mindset. There are literally hundreds of ways to approach the same situation. But sometimes that anxiety-provoking situation that's always provoked anxiety, you feel like there's only one way, there's only one outcome. So the book encourages you to use your creative mind to come up with five different ways to change that, to approach it in a different way, to end it in a different way, to make the middle different. And in doing that, you start to see the power of mindset shift, and you start to kind of practice that positive brain plasticity, that learning of your creative muscle, brain muscle, that will help you address your anxiety situations in a new way, and you're bound to find a way that will lower your anxiety levels.
Wendy, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Wendy Suzuki from New York University. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. Coming up after the news, we want to hear your best recipe for potatoes, or maybe your biggest potato cooking question. It's a special potato edition of Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, on this week's edition of Food Friday, a side dish takes the starring role. Potatoes are one of the most versatile foods out there, and our next guest has lots of ideas and recipes, along with some general advice on making great dinners at home. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you like to prepare potatoes and or eat said potatoes? Roasted, fried, braised, baked, twice baked, mashed? Love to hear your recipes, your advice. Do you have a favorite kind of potato? Do you have a question for our guest about what goes wrong maybe when making a potato dish? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Molly Stevens is a Vermont-based cooking teacher, recipe developer, editor, and cookbook author whose books include All About Roasting, One Potato, Two Potato, and her most recent All About Dinner, Simple Meals, Expert Advice. Molly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, it's one of your older cookbooks, but you did a whole book about potatoes. What gets you excited about potatoes that you could put that much effort and love into them?
Yeah, it's a big book, too. It's over 300 recipes. Yeah, you know, Rob, when I I co-authored the book with a good friend of mine, Roy Finnemore, and when he actually came up with the idea for the book, I took a moment and said, really, a whole book on potatoes? Because I love potatoes, I always have, but I was a little concerned that I might tire of them after, you know, a year and a half or so that it takes to develop all those recipes. But I have to tell you, Rob, I love them more after I wrote the book than before.
Do you have a favorite variety of potato to cook with? Or is it, you know, mission dependent? You like this kind of potato for that, this kind of potato for that?
It's a little of both. I mean, my favorite one is the one that's on my kitchen counter that's about to become dinner. But The variety, that's exactly, I think, what really turned me on to the potential of potatoes is when I first started thinking about it, I was like, well, there's a red potato and a white potato and a russet potato. But once you really delve into it, my goodness, it goes on and on in terms of varieties. And more as our farmers markets and specialty markets and even just regular supermarkets expand the variety that's available. And they all, you know, they have different tastes, they have different characteristics, and yet they're incredibly forgiving. I mean, you don't have to like have just this special potato for this special dish, but it's really fun to kind of go down a potato rabbit hole, if you will.
And stepping aside from potatoes, I mean, potatoes are a good fit for this. In All About Dinner, you make the case that the point that really good home-cooked meals don't have to be incredibly complicated and fussy. Can you talk a little bit about your philosophy of dinners?
You know, I've been cooking for a long time, and I've taught cooking for a long time at a lot of different venues. And you know, the simplest way to learn how to cook is to cook. And the simplest way to cook is to make a meal for yourself, for your household, or whoever you have, your neighbor, whoever you happen to be around. And I mean, something as simple as baking a potato, boiling an egg, frying an egg, doing something, just that simple act of cooking doesn't have to be complicated. And you feed yourself and you discover things and you learn things. I don't know, it develops a self-sufficiency. I can't say enough about how much better things can be if we learn to cook for ourselves.
It's Food Friday. We're talking about potatoes with cookbook author Molly Stevens, author of books including One Potato, Two Potato, and her most recent All About Dinner, Simple Meals, Expert Advice. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite kind of potato, a favorite way to cook potatoes or recipe, or do you need some advice? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can find some recipes from our guest over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's, Molly, check one of those out now. It's party potatoes, a mashed potato that is a crowd pleaser. Can you tell us what makes this one special?
Yeah, party potatoes. And I chose that recipe for now because we're kind of gearing up for the holidays, and it's one that I do for the holidays because it's, you know, mashed potatoes are a given on a lot of holiday tables. Maybe on yours, Rob? Maybe.
Oh yeah, no, I like making mashed potatoes with some pratfalls. Yeah. I'll ask you about in a minute. But
oh good. So anyway, party potato is it's a mashed potato casserole, if you will, meaning you can make it ahead, and that's why it really works for me and my situation. I can make it ahead and take it to where I'm going for Thanksgiving, and it gets enriched with a few little extra things, cream cheese being one of them, that adds both a really great tang, but it also gives you this incredible creamy, fluffy, if those two go together, texture that lasts. Because the problem with mashed potatoes, if they sit around too long, they can just kind of get gluey. But yeah, this party potato dish, it's a make-ahead casserole, and you can actually use your KitchenAid blender or any mixer to make it. And then I the party potato version is pretty straightforward seasonings-wise, but I play around with it and add horseradish or scallions or all sorts of things, just depending on, you know, what way you want to go with that menu.
And you just teased my pratfall. Usually my mashed potatoes come out great, but every once in a while they get, I don't know, like oversaturated or something. And like you said, they end up kind of gluey. How can I make sure I never, ever do that again?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are a couple things. The first is going back to those types of potato. The best potato for a mashed potato, well, the classic, I should say. I want to say the best because there's different ways. But the classic is a russet, an Idaho. I don't know, they go by different things in different parts of the country. But it's the big old baking potato, a big starchy, dry potato. And what makes those so great for mashed potatoes is they're super starchy, which means they're super thirsty. So they love to absorb as much butter and milk and sour cream and heavy cream, whatever you want to throw at them. So they're a great vehicle for a lot of enrichment. Do you know, Rob, when they haven't worked well for you, what type of potato you used?
I think it might have been russet, but it's been a while since I botched them that badly, I'll be honest with you. Mostly I'm doing pretty good lately.
Good. I love to use a ricer, which is kind of an old-fashioned tool for mashing the potatoes, and that helps to get a really fluffy texture. Mm. Another really great tip for getting a really dry mashed potato is after. So you boil the potato, right? And then you drain it. And then put the back on the stove in that pan without any fat, without anything, and sort of shake them around for a little bit and really dry them out before you start adding things. Oh. Because if they're not really dry and you try to add things, they're just going to end up soupy and, as you say, maybe even a little bit gluey. So I tend to peel and chunk them in big chunks, like, you know, baseball, golf ball size chunks, not too small, before I boil them. And then as soon as they're, you know, tender, drain them, put them back in the pot, low heat, and just really shake that pot around. And you'll see a film of starchy potato film on the bottom of the pan. And that's a sign that you've got them really, really dry. Then you can start to mash them and slowly add your enrichments.
Excellent. Well, let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Timothy is with us in southern Minnesota. Timothy, hi.
Hi. Hi, Molly. Huge fan of One Potato and also All About Roasting and All About Braising. My question is, I know you've had a lot of students over the years, and you've worked with a lot of at-home cooks, and you were talking about how experience can really is kind of the number one thing that can help people become better cooks. Are there other things that people can do that would kind of help them accelerate or become more confident in the kitchen?
Timothy.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Molly.
Yeah. No, thanks for calling. Yeah. What can help besides experience? Reading. I'm a big fan of reading cookbooks, finding cookbooks you love, and then sort of following the thread of those cookbooks. You know, there's so much online right now that I find it's remarkable how much you can find. And also, you know, friends, I find sharing with friends who like to cook, and I know it's, you know, been difficult over the past couple, how long it's been, but year or so that we've been able to get together. But even if it's like we do these potlucks where somebody cooks something and then somebody else brings something and you sort of swap recipes that way. So that's how I help, you know, advance my own, creativity is by sort of surrounding myself with friends or reaching out to other friends or I try something, I say, how'd you make that? Or if you're at a restaurant, to ask questions. And also, I don't know where you shop, but if you do shop at farmers markets and things, I find that farmers can be an incredible source of ideas for how to prepare various things. So I guess those are a few of my, and then tasting. The other thing about cooking that I don't think I talk about enough and a lot of people is when you're learning to cook, obviously, cooking is really important, but tasting as you go, tasting your ingredients. I talk about this in All About Dinner, my latest book, but just starting, throughout the whole process, tasting as you're going, and you're going to learn so much about the process if you do it that way.
Thanks a lot for that call, Timothy. We're talking to cooking teacher and cookbook author Molly Stevens about mainly potatoes on this edition of Food Friday. Her books include One Potato, Two Potato, and her most recent, All About Dinner. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite potato, a favorite potato dish? Do you need some general cooking advice, especially dinner-related cooking advice from Molly? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page and find a couple recipes from Molly at wpr.org/foodfriday. Coming up, we'll check out another fancier roasted potato recipe. At least it looks fancier. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our Food Friday talk with Molly Stevens, author of the cookbooks One Potato, Two Potato, and All About Dinner, among others. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your potato favorites or questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Hayward. Tom, hi.
Hi. Say, I was wondering, in your opinion, what's the best potato for potato salad? When I make it, I typically make about, 5 pounds of potatoes. And I use celery, radishes. For every potato, I put in an egg and a red onion and mayo and then a little sour cream. And it's very good, Lowry seasoned salt. But the next day, it's runny. And I was wondering, am I using the wrong potato? I usually use, like, russets or something.
Hmm. Interesting, Tom. Sounds delicious. Molly, any thoughts for Tom?
Yeah. Tom, thanks for calling. You said you use russets generally?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, by the way, your salad sounds great. Sounds like a real classic. And the russet is going to be, I find, a little soft for potato salad. So, and it'll lose its shape a little bit more quickly. So what you might try is going with what we call a red potato or a boiling potato. Some people call it a waxy potato, but the sort of Yukon Gold is another thing. It's kind of a medium starch potato. So it's going to give you a little bit more of that soft texture that you might be used to with your russet, but it's going to hold up a little bit better. So I would say try using a red or white kind of boiling potato, and that might hold up a little bit better. The other thing is it depends on, how, you know, you said you're using radishes and celery, and those things can start to weep a little bit when it sits in the dressing, especially if there is a lot of that seasoning salt. So, you know, every potato salad that's got that's well seasoned and has a little bit of fresh vegetables, fresh crunchy things will weep a little bit, but it shouldn't get super soggy. So another thing you could do is you could just lightly dress the potatoes that you want to eat that day, that most of them, and save the rest and dress them the next day. Those would be two ways around it.
Tom, thanks a lot. Hope that helps. Before we go back to our callers, Molly, I want to check out another recipe you shared. Again, it's at WPR.org/Food Friday. Mustard crusted roast potatoes. Sounds really good. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, well, I wanted to sneak that one in, Rob, because I wrote a book all about roasting, so obviously I'm a big fan of roasted food. And this, the mustard crusted roasted potatoes, speaking about Tom's potato salad, it almost looks like a potato salad before you put it in the oven, because you put a pretty good amount of mustard and olive oil and a little bit of lemon juice. So it's almost like a raw potato salad and then you put it on a sheet pan or a baking sheet and put it in the oven and roast it at a pretty high temperature. And it gets super crunchy. Those really killer French fries that almost have a crust on them. It's reminiscent of that, but it's got all this flavor in it. So it's a really wonderful, a way to kind of, fancify or dress up your basic roast potatoes. And for that, I do use like a red potato.
And I got to ask, what kind of mustard? We've got a whole museum here in Wisconsin and Middleton about mustard. Which kind of mustard goes into this potato dish?
Well, that would be dealer's choice. It would affect how it would turn out. I like it with a Dijon, but I also like to mix Dijon and a whole grain. But I bet you've got some pretty nice, honey mustards and sort of sweetened mustards out there that would do it too, that would work nicely too. You just want to be careful if you add something that's too sweet, it'll brown extra quickly because of those sugars.
Find that mustard crusted roast potato recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll go back to your calls now. Patty is with us in Eau Claire. Patty, hello.
Hi. I make a sweet potato gnocchi. And after I boil the gnocchi, I fry it with vegetables. And I always end up, gnocchi always ends up sticking to the pan, and I lose some of the potato on the bottom of the pan. Any suggestions about how to resolve that?
Great, Patty. So are you, after you cook the sweet potato, are you then mixing it with flour and things?
Yeah, so I cook the sweet potato, then I mix it with flour, a quarter cup of Parmesan cheese, half a cup of ricotta cheese, and then I mix it into a ball, and then you get the strings out, you roll it out into a string, and then you cut it into gnocchi size.
Yep. And then you boil them, right?
I boil the gnocchi for about 2 or 3 minutes. And I'm just wondering if I'm not drying the gnocchi enough before I put it into the pan.
Yeah, I would say a couple things. I would say you could try adding a little bit more flour, although you want, as you know, the more flour you add, the tougher they're going to be. So if that feels like you have a nice texture, after you boil them, make sure you dry them and even lay them out on a clean dish towel or paper towels if you want, on a plate or a tray or a baking sheet, and really let them dry. I would even refrigerate them for a little bit if you have time, just to really dry them out. And then when you're sauteing them, just make sure you've got plenty of oil or fat or butter or something in the pan. And I, if you do cook with a nonstick pan, that would be a super help there too. But just, I think if you could make sure they're cool and fully dry, that should help you quite a bit.
Thanks a lot for the call, Patty, at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. We're talking about potatoes with Molly Stevens, author of cookbooks, including One Potato, Two Potato, and All About Dinner. Let's go back to your calls now with Donna in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Donna.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up?
I always make lefse, and of course I make it with russet potatoes, but someone said you can make lefse with sweet potatoes. I was wondering if your guest has ever tried that.
Wow. I've never made lefse with sweet potatoes, but now I want to try it. I think it's a great idea. The thing I would be, what do you, when you make your lefse, you want to tell people how you make it?
Well, I boil the potatoes and then I rice them and then I rice them again and then I rice them again and then add butter and all of the other ingredients and just add the flour just before I roll out the lefse.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful. I think the thing I would caution with sweet potato is it doesn't have the starch of the russet potato. So it's going to be a lot wetter. So you're going to need to add more flour. One thing I think what I would try, and this is sometimes kind of goes back to Timothy's question, when I try to make changes to recipes, I often make incremental changes. Mm. So what I might do is I might make a half sweet potato, half russet potato lefse to start with and see how it goes and you know, judge that way. Because I'm afraid if I went all the way to a sweet potato the first time, it might just end up a big sloppy mess or I'd have to add too much flour. And then back to the gnocchi question, it's just going to be tough. So I think I'd start by trying a half and half and it would get this pretty, really beautiful color and some of the sweetness from the potato, but still have that wonderful tender texture that you want in your lefse.
Donna, thanks a lot for that call. I want to take a couple minutes. Yeah, it was. A couple of minutes to talk about braising, Molly, which you've written a book about. We saw a piece you wrote about braising fall vegetables, potatoes, and sweet potatoes, and all the other great stuff that's up this time of year. First of all, could you just give us the basics of how we braise these root vegetables this time of year?
Right. Braised vegetables is such a... It's probably going to make some for supper tonight. When I started talking about braising, when I wrote the book all about braising, I thought I'd be braising all these big cuts of meat. And of course I did, but braised vegetables, you just get such incredible flavors, especially with all, as you mentioned, the root vegetables. So something as simple as a pan of braised potatoes, you just put a layer of potatoes in the bottom of a pan and add a few aromatics. Maybe it's a sprig of rosemary or a simple bay leaf, a little bit of, it could be water, it could be broth. And then a little bit of butter or olive oil and just simmer it with a lid on over low heat till they're tender. And you just get, it's one of those things where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, just all these wonderful flavors and tenderness.
That sounds super good. Okay. I'm going to bring you a question that comes up in my life pretty often, Molly. I like to make oven fries. Sometimes they come out nice and crispy. Sometimes they're just sort of soggy fry shaped potatoes. Any advice on getting them crispy more or less every time?
Yeah, if you want, that happens to all of us. And potatoes, even though it's classified as a starchy potato, those starches change during the season or change during storage. So if you want your oven fries perfect every time, you need to take a cue from the fast food and the restaurant pros. You need to twice cook them. So what I do is I parboil them. I cut them into sticks, French fry sticks, parboil them, not till they're tender, but just so they're just starting to cook. Pull them out, drain them again. Then I coat them with a little bit of oil and into a hot oven. And you could do it a little bit ahead. But again, the same thing we talked about, you want to dry them out, we'll cool them down a little bit and then into the hot oven. And they're going to, you'll end up with crispy brown, delicious French fries.
Whoa. Okay. I'm going to skip the rest of the show. I want to go try that right now. Know, Molly, right? Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Rob, it was great to talk to you. Have a great weekend.
You too. That's Molly Stevens, a Vermont-based cooking teacher, recipe developer, editor, and cookbook author. We talked to her today about a lot of the things she's written about. Her books include One Potato, Two Potato. Her most recent is All About Dinner. Hey, there's still time for you to share your Potato Land favorites over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you like. We actually heard from Darlene on Facebook who says purple potatoes right out of the garden box, cooked with onions, curry powder, vegetable broth, canned whole tomatoes, and a splash of coconut creamer, cooked for 6 minutes in the Instant Pot. Simple, Darlene says, and awesome. share your simple and awesome potato recipes on the Ideas Network Facebook page, and check out recipes that Molly shared with us over at wpr.org/foodfriday. I'm going to try a couple of them at home, maybe as soon as this weekend. They sound really good. Also, share your ideas for future Food Fridays. Is there a food or cooking question you want answered, or just something you really like and want to hear more about? You can email your suggestions to ideas@wpr.org, and maybe we'll talk about it on a future edition of Food Friday. Tomorrow is New Year's Day, so I thought I'd share one of my New Year's radio memories. On a New Year's Day, 20-ish years ago, I filled in as host on our morning show. It was the Tom Clark Show at the time. I hadn't been on the air a lot at that point. The 6 a.m. was an open call-in segment. No guest. People could share their New Year's resolutions. You could see where the problem might come up. In years past, we had gotten callers in that 6 o'clock hour. On New Year's Day, I screened those callers. Many of them were sober. That year, where I was completely counting on callers, nothing for the first 20-plus minutes. So it was just me talking, sharing common resolution ideas, begging people to call, coming up with one resolution after another of my own on the air. Finally, people took pity on me and started calling in. Later that week, I ran into an acquaintance who said he really enjoyed the part where it's just me talking. I said, thanks, but why didn't you call? Hope your new year gets off to a good start. This is Central Time.